This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Setting the Table, The Transforming Power of Hospitality in Business. Written and read by Danny Meyer. Copyright 2006 by Danny Meyer. Production and abridgment copyright 2006 by HarperCollins Publishers. Over the course of the past 21 years, I've opened and operated 5 white tablecloth restaurants, an urban barbecue joint, a feel-good jazz club, a neo-roadside stand selling frozen custard burgers and hot dogs, 3 modern museum cafes, and an off-premises restaurant quality catering company. So far, I haven't had the experience of closing any of them, and I pray I never will. My business is very much in the public eye. It's highly scrutinized, and it invites passionate opinions from experts and amateurs alike. A debate between people about their favorite restaurant can take on the heat of a political or religious discourse. And if you want to persist and thrive, you'd better not rest on your laurels. Every time you look up, there's another new, eager competitor trying to attract the attention and affection of the public and the media, each hell-bent on tasting and weighing in on the newest thing. But there's nothing I'd rather be doing. I was born to go into business for myself, and I was destined to find a business that would allow me to share with others my enthusiasm for things I find pleasurable. My craving for the adventures of travel, food, and wine is what first compelled me to do what I do. In fact, like so many other entrepreneurs I've met, I'm not even sure I had much of a choice. A career in the restaurant business was going to tap me on the shoulder even if I hadn't found it first. All these years later, the delights of the table continue to stimulate me as I pursue my career. But what really challenges me to get up and go to work every day, and has also motivated me to make this recording, is my deep conviction about the intense human drive to provide and receive hospitality, well beyond the world of restaurants. Within moments of being born, most babies find themselves receiving the first 4 gifts of life: eye contact, a smile, a hug, and some food. We receive many other gifts in a lifetime, but few can ever surpass those first 4. That first time may be the purest hospitality transaction we'll ever have, and it's not much of a surprise that we'll crave those gifts for the rest of our lives. I know I do. My appreciation of the power of hospitality and my desire to harness it have been the greatest contributor to whatever success my restaurants and businesses have had. I've learned how crucially important it is to put hospitality to work, first for the people who work for me, and subsequently for all the other people and stakeholders who are in any way affected by our business. In descending order, our guests, community, suppliers, and investors. I call this way of setting priorities enlightened hospitality. It stands some more traditional business approaches on their head, but it's the foundation of every business decision and every success we've ever had. You may think, as I once did, that I'm primarily in the business of serving good food. Actually, though, food is secondary to something that matters even more. In the end, what's most meaningful is creating positive, uplifting outcomes for human experiences and human relationships. Business, like life, is all about how you make people feel. It's that simple. And it's that hard. From as far back as I can remember, I've been eating with my eyes, nose, and mouth. When I was 4, I fell in love with stone crab at the Lagoon restaurant in Miami Beach. I couldn't stop eating it, and apparently I couldn't stop talking to anyone who would listen about the quacked crab. Over the next years, I remember savoring variations of key lime pie in Key West, eating my first roadside cheeseburger somewhere in the hills outside Santa Barbara, trying Dungeness crab and saline abalone at San Francisco's Fisherman's Wharf, and having a lobster roll in Ogunquit, Maine. I devoured my first custardy quiche Lorraine as a 7-year-old when my parents took us to the city of Nancy in France. I tasted bottled water, Evian and Vittel, for the first time in the town of Talwar, and I can also remember exactly how the water of Lake Annecy tasted as I swam in it. I discovered fraise des bois, wild strawberries, and crème fraîche at La Colombe d'Or in Saint-Paul-de-Vence. I tasted a baguette with saucisson and pungent moutarde in Paris's Jardin des Tuileries. My writing improved because my mother insisted that I keep a diary of our trip. At the time, I hated doing this, but the diary turned out to be one of the greatest gifts she ever gave me. I wasn't writing about the museums and churches we'd seen. Instead, I chose to write about food. Back in my hometown of St. Louis, I was no less curious about what people ate. When I brought my lunch from home to elementary school, I swapped and shared sandwiches, not because the other kids' lunches were better, but because this was the best way I knew of to learn about another family. I had never heard of Miracle Whip until I traded my Braunschweiger on rye with another kid for his bologna sandwich, one slice of Oscar Mayer and Miracle Whip on tasty white bread. It tasted nothing like the Hellman's mayonnaise we used at home, and I began to understand something about families solely on the basis of their preference for Hellman's or Miracle Whip. I was fascinated to discover that the household across the street used Mall's, the thin, tangy, classic St. Louis barbecue sauce, whereas my family was in the more mainstream open pit camp, using it as a base to be doctored with other ingredients. I learned that various brands of peanut butter tasted better with certain brands of jelly. I observed that some families chose Heinz ketchup, while others used Hunt's or Brooks. I got to know and care about the differences in the flavors of these ketchups. These explorations of food not only taught me about myself and others, but were central factors in how and why I chose to go into the restaurant business, and perhaps even in why the restaurants have fared so well. My discoveries have also convinced me that there's always someone out there who has figured out how to make something taste just a little bit better. And I'm inspired both by the search and the discovery. The restaurants and other businesses I've opened in New York City, Union Square Cafe, Gramercy Tavern, 11 Madison Park, Tabla, Blue Smoke, Jazz Standard, Shake Shack, The Modern, Cafe 2, and Terrace 5, which are our cafes for visitors within the Museum of Modern Art, plus Hudson Yards Catering, were all conceived and are all driven by a passion to add something new and compelling to what I call a dialogue between what already exists and what could be. Whether the subject is Indian spices, new American cuisine, the neighborhood bistro, barbecue, luxe dining, a big league jazz club, the traditional museum cafeteria, or hamburgers and milkshakes, my passion is always to explore the object of my interest in depth, and then to combine the best of what I found with something unexpected to create a fresh context. I then look at the result and ask myself and my colleagues what it would take to do this even better. Creating restaurants or even recipes is like composing music. There are only so many notes in the scale from which all melodies and harmonies are created. The trick is to put those notes together in a way not heard before. For us, the ongoing challenge has been to combine the best elements of fine dining with accessibility, in other words, with open arms. This was once a radical concept in my business, where excellent cuisine was almost always paired with stiff arm's-length service. Sometimes we've moved in the other direction, beginning with the casual atmosphere of a barbecue joint or a shakes and burger stand, and then attempting to exceed expectations by employing a caring staff and using the finest ingredients. Our formula is a lot tougher to achieve than it sounds, but it can be applied successfully to virtually any business you can name. Where does my hunger for good food served with thoughtful care and consistency come from? Why am I so energized by seeking to uncover the best? The answer is my family, though its various influences on me have often been at odds. My three most important male role models were businessmen with profoundly different business philosophies, personalities, and styles. My parents, Roxanne and Morton Lewis Meyer, had spent the first 2 years of their youthful marriage in the early 1950s living in the city of Nancy, capital of the French province of Lorraine, where my dad was posted as an Army intelligence officer. He was the son of Morton Meyer, a St. Louis businessman who had been educated at Princeton and ran a chemical company there called Thompson Hayward. Grandpa Morton was a visionary civic leader and a die-hard Republican, but one who understood the importance of working effectively with Democrats. For instance, he collaborated with Senator Stuart Symington to raise the funds and forge the coalitions necessary to build the St. Louis flood wall. He was a stoic member of the city's establishment and rarely talked to his family about his work, though he often talked to me about baseball and horse racing. There were no surprises with Grandpa Morton, and I loved him for that. He was in many ways the opposite of his flamboyant entrepreneurial son, my dad, who also attended Princeton, where he demonstrated a flair for languages, having mastered French, Italian, and Latin, and as the managing editor of the Daily Princetonian, English. My mother, too, was the child of a privileged Midwestern family. Her father, Irving B. Harris, was a singular man whose combining of social consciousness with business acumen was an enormous influence on me as a human being and ultimately even as a restaurateur. He graduated from Yale, and he made his first fortune before he was 40 years old, having co-founded the Tony Home Permanent Company with his brother Neeson. They sold it to the Gillette Safety Razor Company in 1948 for what was then an enormous sum, $20 million. Grandpa Irving's piercing analytical business mind was radically different from my father's intuitive entrepreneurialism. Morty, as my dad was known, always had an abundance of new imaginative ideas for companies that he would run, or try to run, by himself. Irving, on the other hand, invested in or acquired other people's businesses, especially when the ideas that defined those companies were compelling to him. His passion wasn't to operate the companies, but rather to bet on the quality of their senior leadership. Evaluating human potential was every bit as important to him as any business idea. My parents' knowledge of and fondness for France was a powerful bond between them. From a very young age, I was lucky to be taken abroad on family vacations, and it was on those trips that I was first immersed in the unaffected, timeless culture of gracious hospitality represented by European restaurateurs and innkeepers. In France, we usually stayed in low-key, family-run inns where the welcome felt loving and the gastronomy was exceptional. Those trips left a lasting impression. The hug that came with the food made it taste even better. That realization would gradually evolve into my own well-defined business strategy, the core of which is hospitality, or being on the guest's side. Hospitality is the foundation of my business philosophy. Virtually nothing else is nearly as important as how one is made to feel in any business transaction. Hospitality exists when you believe the other person is on your side. The converse is just as true. Hospitality is present when something happens for you. It is absent when something happens to you. Those two simple prepositions, for and to, really express it all. In St. Louis, my father parlayed his love of all things French into a career as an innovative and successful travel agent. Among his prized collections were what must have been every back issue of Gourmet, Holiday, and later Travel and Leisure magazines. He also built on a wide range of friendships he and my mother had established with French innkeepers. His agency, Open Road Tours, packaged customized driving trips, often in conjunction with Relais de Compagnie, a network of lovely family-operated inns around France. Relais de Compagnie later evolved into Relais et Chateau, now a prestigious international network of small luxury hotels. My dad remained active with Relais et Chateau for years. He was enormously proud when his own small hotel in St. Louis, the Seven Gables Inn, became affiliated with Relais et Chateau in the late 1980s. This was long before such excursions off the beaten path became common in the travel industry. My dad exulted in planning these driving tours of the countryside. He would note exactly where travelers would stumble upon a certain vineyard, a worthwhile museum, or a particularly good bistro. His clients loved his attention to detail. His businesses thrived, and I was bursting with pride when I got to tell people my dad had become president of the American Society of Travel Agents, also known as ASTA, an important trade organization. At home, too, he and my mom were Eurocentric. They often hosted cocktail parties and dinner parties for friends and business colleagues from France, Italy, and Denmark, who either were in town on business or who had made a detour to St. Louis just to see us. For several years, our house was home to the grown children of French innkeepers. By day, these young people would help out in Dad's office with translations and administrative tasks, and by night, they would act as au pairs for my sister Nancy, my brother Tommy, and me. My father was unquestionably my childhood hero, a hedonist, a gastronome, and a man who cherished and passionately savored life. He loved the excitement and risk of the racetrack, and gave me a taste for it, even when I was too young to place bets legally. Going to the track was a Meyer family tradition of long standing. My dad's parents spent most of every August in Saratoga, New York, going to the track 6 days a week for nearly a month. Dad also took risks as a businessman. He was always coming up with exciting new ideas based on his love of travel and food, and on his constant drive to share his finds with others. At one point, Open Road Tours had offices and staffs in Chicago, Los Angeles, New York, and Paris. Later, it opened offices all over Europe, and I'll never forget the day he proudly showed off an Open Road stock certificate bearing the name of Ava Gardner as an investor. I never fully understood how or why, but sometime in the late 1960s, when I was still a young boy, Open Road Tours went bankrupt. I remember abundant tears and shame, but few details. I heard comments like, "We expanded too quickly," and I had thoughts like, "My hero failed." In 1970, when I was 12, my father leaped into the hotel business in Italy. Despite the pleas of my mother and with Grandpa Irving's begrudging help in the form of a $1 million loan, he committed himself to long leases on one hotel in Rome and another in Milan. He was certain that becoming a hotelier would be his ticket to fortune. My mom, correctly, maintained that it promised nothing more than protracted absences from home. There was always some reason my dad had to go to Italy. Each time the hotel workers went on strike, he flew to Rome or Milan to help make beds. Business flagged and lagged, and although he was spending half a month at a time away from his family addressing problems, it inevitably proved impossible for him to operate a hotel business across two continents. At an enormous financial cost and an even greater emotional cost, my father finally found a buyer for his two leases. He then went on to his next idea. In 1972, still irrepressibly optimistic, my father created another new business called Caesar Associates. This new company would sell packaged group tours at a deep discount for a very narrow niche of travelers known as interliners, airline employees and their families. As members of the International Air Transport Association, also known as IATA, an industry trade group, interliners could fly standby at unbelievably low rates. Dad's business model was simple but original. He aggregated all the discounts to which members of IATA were entitled and packaged imaginative trips lasting up to 2 weeks. In addition to low airfares, he negotiated rock-bottom rates for hotels, ground transport, sightseeing, shopping, and dining. The value he added was to offer highly imaginative itineraries and use the underlying buying power of group travel to create an extraordinary rapport between price and quality. He hired sparkling young tour guides at each destination, and he kept his clients informed of travel opportunities by writing an endless stream of marketing collaterals. He was a terrific writer and editor, and his direct mailings inspired me, years later, to create my own newsletter as a way to reach out to and widen our base at Union Square Cafe. He was always after me to correct every grammatical mistake I ever made or delete every superfluous word I used in the Union Square Cafe newsletter. Caesar Associates actually thrived for many years, with outposts in London, Paris, Copenhagen, Madrid, and Rome. But this success wasn't enough for my father. Having failed to learn some critical lessons from his earlier business failures in the 1960s and 1970s, he gambled the fortunes of his entire business on another new one, involving risky and questionable real estate and hotel deals back in St. Louis. He eventually owned two hotels in St. Louis, one of which, the Seven Gables Inn, with its French restaurant Chez Louis, met with critical acclaim. But the other hotel, the Daniel Hilton, with its mediocre London Grill, was a failure on every count. My father had leveraged his entire company to purchase these hotels, and also to purchase a medical building in Clayton, Missouri, which he planned to reimagine and redevelop into something big. However, by the time he had emptied the building of its existing rent-paying tenants, the bottom had fallen out of the economy. His funders dropped out, but not before suing him. Although Dad may have been an inventive entrepreneur, he did not have the necessary emotional skills or discipline, and he failed to surround himself with enough competent, loyal, trustworthy colleagues whose skills and strengths would have compensated for his own weaknesses. By 1990, shortly before he died of lung cancer at the age of 59, he was once again bankrupt. Once again, he had to inform his family, his second wife Vivian, and his three children and their spouses about a failure. We all had a very painful sense of deja vu. Looking back, I realized that gambling is a metaphor for how my father ran his businesses, and my deep fear of repeating his mistakes has always colored the way I run mine. Because each of his doomed experiences was marked by overly rapid expansion, I've always been afraid to expand my business too quickly. I'm not risk-averse, but I have tight self-control, and I'm not ordinarily a gambler. I go to Saratoga one weekend a year, and losing even a $10 bet at the track there bothers me enormously. Still, I've been willing to make a $1 million bet on a new restaurant. I'm far more inclined to take risks when I'm essentially betting on myself, but I can do that only because I've surrounded myself with highly talented people of solid integrity. I'm also far more confident in my ability to handicap humans than horses. My father, on the other hand, never felt compelled to surround himself with people who were better or smarter at anything than he believed he was. He had a greater need to feel important, to be agreed with, to be the king. It was no coincidence that he named his company after Caesar. While I too love sitting in the captain's chair, my greatest joy comes not from going it alone, but from leading an ensemble. Hospitality is a team sport. As a young teenager back home in St. Louis, I cooked for friends. I would take something as simple as a hot dog or a knockwurst and slice it down the middle, stuffing it with cheese and wrapping it with a slice of bacon before grilling it in the barbecue pit. I created my own signature barbecue sauce by mixing open pit with ketchup, crushed garlic, Worcestershire sauce, brown sugar, a dash of cayenne, and loads of cracked black pepper. I learned to make pizza from scratch. I was proud of my recipe for tacos. My friends enjoyed what they ate when they came over to our house, except for my mother's broiled chicken livers, and most of them seemed to get a kick out of the fact that each visit would be spent playing basketball, football, hockey, or ping pong, and then cooking. During my adolescence, food continued to figure prominently in my life. In the 10th grade, I took cooking lessons in home economics, and as one of only two guys in the class, I furthered more than just my culinary interests. I got nearly straight A's during my first term at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. Following my sophomore year, I went to Rome to work as a host at Caesar Associates and a guide for my father's interline tours. Our three packages in Italy varied, including visits to Naples, Sorrento, Capri, and Pompeii, and an intensive tour of Rome. Our premier trip was the Gran Giro d'Italia, a comprehensive bus tour to Assisi, Florence, and Venice, and then back to Rome. To me, this was hospitality boot camp, a rigorous but excellent training for satisfying the emotional needs of my dad's customers, who would typically arrive jet-lagged and crabby. After meeting them at the airport following their overnight flight to Rome, we'd board a tour bus, and I'd get on the microphone to describe the trip ahead. Next, it was on to the hotel, where I'd help them all check in and settle into their rooms for a nap. Then, after a few hours, I'd gather the woozy bunch together for an afternoon welcome meeting over Asti Spumante and rum cake. My first priority was to identify the crankiest clients and win them over. Having discovered a number of mom-and-pop Roman trattorias on my own, my favorite was La Taverna da Giovanni, where I spent even my days off happily feasting on spaghetti alla carbonara and roast pig, I could tell my travelers that I knew of an amazing family-run place that very few tourists ever found. They loved that. I improvised on my dad's official itineraries whenever I could and steered the travelers to lunch or dinner at one of these authentic restaurants. Not only would I get to eat for free, but the owners would typically pay me a commission, una mancia, of 1,000 lira for every guest I delivered. 1,000 lira bought me a cappuccino, a brioche, and a sugo d'albicocca, apricot nectar, for breakfast at my favorite coffee bar. I loved earning tips, and this was an easy and enjoyable way to earn extra cash, not just from the trattoria owners, but also from my grateful tourists, who rewarded me handsomely for making their visit special and for just being nice. My father, thanks to a specious deal he had struck with Lineas Arias de Nicaragua, also known as Lanica, making him a consultant for the airline at a fee of $1 a year, now qualified himself for those incredible interliner airfares. And as a child of a consultant for Lanica, I also qualified to fly to Europe for just $44 round trip until I was 21. Throughout my college years, I could not afford not to fly Pan Am to Italy for any long weekend. I would just call my dad and he'd handwrite a $44 ticket and mail it to me. I learned Italian by taking classes at school and from traveling in Italy. I fell madly in love with Rome, Florence, and Venice. During my sophomore year at Trinity College in 1977, my parents, after years of a deteriorating marital situation, at last separated. Another painful issue was that by this time my dad was increasingly expressing himself loudly in public settings, driving somewhat recklessly, and drinking more than he could handle. He continued to make foolish choices in his business life. We were drifting apart. As my family divided, I increasingly comforted myself with food. By the second semester of my junior year, I was headed back to Rome. This time it was to spend 4 months at Trinity's campus there, ostensibly to study international politics, the Italian language, and art history. But my real interests were, first, being far away from home, and second, as I would soon learn, eating. I memorized every Roman entry in the Red Michelin Guide to Italy, even though most of Michelin's selections were fancier than the kind of trattorias that I preferred. I went out for dinner almost every night, wandering every obscure via, alone or with friends, reviewing the menu boxes outside every trattoria. I was always searching for the one unique thing at any given restaurant. While I was living in and later returning often to Rome, I was intrigued to discover that every trattoria had basically the same menu. Each had spaghetti alla carbonara, melanzane alla matriciana, melanzane alla parmigiana, and coda alla vaccinara. I could see the trattorias in Rome distinguish themselves by nuances, how each chef cooked a classic dish. Furthermore, the trattorias possessed a subtle quality that was every bit as important as the food, a genuinely welcoming spirit that led to the formation of a community of regulars. It's hard not to fall in love with a society that is confident about and content with its traditions so that it doesn't need to eat a different kind of food every day at lunch and every evening at dinner. I came to love the ritual of dining each evening at the same time with the same people and eating the same foods. This runs counter to the compulsion in our culture to continually change channels. When it came time for me to open my own restaurant for New Yorkers, there was no question in my mind that I would embrace all I had learned in Italy and that the Roman trattoria would be my richest inspiration. But I wasn't there yet. After graduating from Trinity in 1980, I moved to Chicago, where, after a brief stint at the public station WTTW-TV in pursuit of a possible career in journalism, I became the $214 a week Cook County field coordinator for John Anderson's presidential campaign. Anderson, the nominee of the Independent Party, was running against Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. It was a brutally intense experience that fired up my passion for politics and also taught me a thing or two about management, even though I was on the wrong end of a landslide. Learning to manage volunteers to whom, absent a paycheck, ideas and ideals were the only currency, taught me to view all employees essentially as volunteers. Today, even with compensation as a motivator, I know that anyone who works for my company chooses to do so because of what we stand for. I believe that anyone who's qualified for a job in our company is also qualified for many other jobs at the same pay scale. It's up to us to provide solid reasons for our employees to want to work for us over and beyond their compensation. I decided that my next stop had to be New York, a city I had always loved to visit for stimulating weekends when I was at Trinity. I would drive down for a day of museum going or horse racing and an evening of restaurants, Broadway theater, or jazz. I loved the pulse of New York and decided to try living there for a year or so. This time I didn't object to Grandpa Irving's help, and he lined up a job for me with Checkpoint Systems, a small but growing company that manufactured and sold electronic tags and pressure-sensitive labels to stop shoplifters. My grandfather had been an early principal investor there. I was hired as a special projects manager at a salary of $16,500 in January 1981, and I spent most of my time assisting the sales force. By the end of my first year, another position opened up, and I was offered a sales job in charge of the entire New York territory. Soon I became Checkpoint's top salesman covering the New York metropolitan area and earning nearly $100,000 in commissions. I quickly got to know every branch of every family tree of every New York retailing family that owned drugstores, clothing stores, grocery stores, coat stores, and shoe stores. I was making cold calls, meeting people, and getting to know every obscure corner of New York City. As I had learned during Anderson's campaign, I was reaching out and building a constituency. This was another indispensable lesson that would serve me well as a restaurateur. I also became Checkpoint's expert on training grocery store chains and the ways and means of preventing loss. Thereafter, I was sent out to travel and train around the United States. Naturally, I spent every free moment checking out local restaurants, and I made some important gastronomic discoveries. In Detroit, I visited the Golden Mushroom and the London Chop House. In California, I tasted food cooked by the chefs Wolfgang Puck, Alice Waters, Mark Miller, and Jeremiah Tower, who were at the forefront of the new American cuisine. At Spago, I tried Puck's New Wave Pizza with duck sausage and shiitake mushrooms. This was no fancy restaurant, but it was fun, an exciting place to experience an emerging, unfussy American cuisine based on the simple, fresh Italian and French cooking that I had grown up loving, combined with seasonal local California produce. A lot was happening out west, while New York was still primarily rooted in old-school French and Italian cooking. Still, I preferred New York to any other place. I was Checkpoint's top salesman for 3 years running and was consistently motivated by the competitive urge to lead the pack. Earning top commissions was the icing on the cake, and with no one to support but myself, I was putting money in the bank. I loved art and went to the Museum of Modern Art as often as possible, taking advantage of my grandfather's annual gift to me of a membership there. I was devouring New York. I could take myself on little adventures all over town, and I loved being able to eat out and learn. I'd map out an entire day of sales calls, basing my schedule on where to eat and whatever borough I had to visit that day. It could be a Greek diner in Astoria, a Jewish deli or Popeye's Fried Chicken in Brooklyn, or even an Olive Garden in Peekskill. That was the best restaurant in Peekskill at the time. By night, I would dine following the advice of the New York Times' restaurant critic Mimi Sheraton, or better still, making a sport of discovering new places on my own. And during this time, I was cooking like crazy out of cookbooks and gourmet magazine. I lived in Yorkville, a neighborhood famous for its German butchers and Hungarian spice stores. I took cooking classes from an exceptional cook, a dynamic woman named Andre Abramoff. She was an Egyptian-born Jew who had split her childhood between France and Egypt, and her restaurant, Andre's Mediterranean Cuisine, was one of my favorites. She taught cooking out of her townhouse on East 74th Street, which also housed Andre's. There I learned to make spanakopita, bouillabaisse, and rack of lamb. I enrolled in a restaurant management class at the New York Restaurant School. In late 1983, Checkpoint asked me to lead the launch of an office in London. But I felt it was time to move on to something different. It was time to grow up and pursue my life's career. I enrolled in a Stanley Kaplan prep course for the law boards. My new plan was to practice law as a prelude to a career in politics or public service. That was my fantasy. In reality, I was lost. The night before taking the LSAT, I had dinner at Elio's on 2nd Avenue with my aunt and uncle, Virginia and Richard Polsky, and my grandmother, Rosetta Harris. I chose not to drink wine because the test was being given early the next morning. I told my uncle, "I can't believe I'm doing this LSAT thing tomorrow. I don't even want to be a lawyer." "So why are you?" Richard Polsky asked in an exasperated tone. "You know you don't want to be a lawyer. Why don't you just do what you've been thinking about doing your whole life?" "What's that?" I asked him. "What do you mean, what's that? Since you were a child, all you've ever talked or thought about is food and restaurants. Why don't you just open a restaurant?" The idea felt, at the same time, both foreign and like an absolute bullseye. The next morning, completely relaxed, I took the LSAT, and then I never bothered to apply to a single law school. From that moment on, I was off to the races. My first job in the restaurant business began in the bitterly cold, snowy January of 1984 as a daytime assistant manager at Pesca, a San Francisco-inspired Italian seafood restaurant on East 22nd Street. Among my tasks were taking reservations, typing out the daily specials, running to the copy store to get them Xeroxed, and stuffing them in Lucite holders to be presented at each table. I would check in waiters, host lunch by greeting and seating mostly regular guests, and, when I was really lucky, get to sit in on menu planning meetings or wine tastings in the kitchen. The busy restaurant, which had a successful 8-year run, was good and ahead of its time. It offered fresh, imaginative Cal-Ital seafood dishes, had a breezy style, and was in an emerging trendy neighborhood. I adored meeting many fascinating people from the worlds of advertising, publishing, and photography, the new denizens of a neighborhood that had just been named the Flatiron District by New York Magazine. My paycheck, $250 a week, down a bit from the $125,000 a year I had earned as a commissioned salesman, did take some adjusting to and getting used to. But I had to pinch myself. At last, I was in the restaurant business, and I was jazzed. I was at Pesca for just 8 months, but in that short time I worked alongside some extraordinary people who would change my life. On my very first day on the job, I literally ran into the woman who would become my wife, 4 years later, and then the remarkable mother of our 4 children. I was pounding down the narrow staircase to the basement office to pick up Pesca's ringing reservation line when I encountered a beautiful, perky waitress named Audrey Heffernan making her way up. For 3 seconds, we looked intently into one another's eyes, and then we moved along. Suddenly, I felt very optimistic about my new vocation. I couldn't wait for day 2 on the job. The next day, however, she was gone. A regional theater and commercial actress who had performed leading roles in Babes in Toyland, Fiddler on the Roof, and Oklahoma, Audrey was on the road, this time to play Sarah Brown in a production of Guys and Dolls in Indianapolis. She had been at Pesca for 2 years and was so beloved by the owner, Eugene Frakia, who called her St. Audrey, that there was always a place for her when she came back to New York. I happened to be manning the reservation lines one day when she called Eugene to tell him she would soon be returning home and wondered when she could get back on the waiter schedule. I wasted no time delivering the message to the general manager, Douglas Scarborough, who found a way to put Audrey back on the schedule almost immediately. She and I flirted for months without acknowledging our feelings or making any kind of move. In late April, as a ruse to get Audrey to see my apartment, I sent out invitations to a dozen members of Pesca's waitstaff for my annual Meyer at the Wire Kentucky Derby party. I was utterly dismayed to learn that her brother was getting married on that very day. I would have to wait a little longer to see her outside the restaurant. Another person whom I met at Pesca and who had an enormous influence on me was the restaurant's bar manager, Gordon Dudash. Gordon possessed a soul of pure hospitality that was exquisite and innate. Behind his elegant good looks and warm smile was a welcoming aura you could sense half a block away. When I opened Union Square Cafe, he was the man I hired to be my bar manager, and eventually he became our general manager. I was devastated when, in 1998, Gordon died of complications from AIDS. AIDS eventually claimed the lives of several of my former colleagues at Pesca, including the restaurant's owner, chef, general manager, and bar manager, and at least one of the waiters. Gordon made a profound impact on my appreciation of the importance and power of genuine hospitality, and I've always been grateful that he lived just long enough to see Union Square Cafe earn its first 3-star review in 1989. I also met a young chef there named Michael Romano. Michael had just returned from a 6-year culinary stint in France and Switzerland and was learning Pesca's system as co-chef because Eugene Frakia, the owner of Pesca, wanted him to become the chef at Lola, a new restaurant that he would soon be opening a couple blocks west on 22nd Street. Sensing a rare talent and knowing that Michael and I would not be together at Pesca very much longer, I vowed to learn every possible thing I could from him. His deft chef skills were apparent. I had never seen anyone handle a knife the way Michael did. Every dish he cooked just seemed to look and taste better than anything else I had previously seen at Pesca. One night a week, I was taking a course at L'Académie du Vin, taught by Melissa and Patrick Serret, and housed in the basement of Lavin's Restaurant, one of the early New York restaurants to feature a deep selection of California wines. Each week, our curriculum focused on wines from a different part of the world. I couldn't take in the information quickly enough, and I'd eagerly share my enthusiasm with colleagues at PESCO whenever I could get anyone to listen. While attending L'Économie du Vin, I had become friendly with a lanky young journalist named Brian Miller, who had recently left his job at the Hartford Courant to write about food for the New York Times. Soon, he was assigned to launch a new Friday column called Diner's Journal. His job was to uncover new restaurants, and he called on me frequently, both as a source for ideas and as a dining companion. In those days before the internet, it was part of a newspaper's mission to be the very first to let the public in on new places. Today, of course, we need only go to any one of several restaurant blogs to get even more up-to-the-minute information. After 8 months at Pesca, I decided it was time to go out into the world and see where it might lead me. I made arrangements through a variety of resources, including my cooking teacher in New York, Andre Abramoff, and my father, to study cooking in Italy and France for the next 3.5 months. These plans at last nudged Audrey and me into action. When she heard I was leaving Pesca, she blurted, "What?" Though we hadn't had even one date at this point, we had been involved in a quiet but determined courting dance. We were the only people to whom we had not acknowledged our mutual attraction. "I think we need to go out to dinner before I leave," I said. On the eve of my last day at Pesca, we did go out, putting together a jam-packed all-night date that was a harbinger of our eventual style as a married couple, never enough hours for all we want to accomplish. We started with drinks at the Algonquin Hotel, barely made the curtain for noises off at the Brooks Atkinson Theater on Broadway, took a cab down to Tribeca for dinner at the Odeon, then perhaps the liveliest and most delicious late-night dining spot south of Canal Street, sauntered over to Le Zinc for after-dinner drinks, and walked all the way up to the West Village for more drinks and conversation at another late favorite restaurant, Texarkana. We meandered up to Audrey's apartment on 22nd Street, which was across the street from Pesca, where we listened to tapes of her singing Broadway tunes and talked until 4 in the morning. At that point, I took a cab uptown to my own place. I was due at work at the restaurant in just a few hours. I got just enough exuberant sleep to have the wherewithal to write a thank you card. My mother's lessons were at last paying useful life dividends, which Audrey found slipped under her door when she woke up later that morning. Pesca had been an invaluable experience, both for the things it taught me to do and for the things it taught me not to do. Ownership and top management were highly secretive about the restaurant's finances. We had no idea what a budget was, much less how to compute a food, beverage, or labor cost. We could only assume, rightly or wrongly, that the restaurant was profitable. Also, the owners ran the restaurant more emotionally than professionally, with their prevailing mood being the primary cues for our performance that we were given on any given day. The owners dined and entertained frequently in their own restaurant, and for those meals, no money was exchanged, no records were kept, and no tips were offered to the employees. Some servers were favorites of the management, others were not. Job interviews often began with an up-and-down physical assessment before any dialogue took place. In fact, that's how my own job interview had begun. I'm amazed that I got the job when I consider my preference for wearing wallabies and corduroys. I was a sponge with eager eyes, and I noticed everything. It was now time to leave and to gain other perspectives on how to run a restaurant. I spent the last 100 days of 1984 soaking up culinary life in Italy and France, much of the time as a stagiaire or chef's apprentice. That's a romantic way of saying I did those kitchen tasks no one else wanted to do, and in which there was no fear that my rudimentary kitchen skills might lead to disaster. In Rome, I worked with and learned cherished recipes from the wonderful family at La Taverna da Giovanni. I was 26 years old, and I seized every free moment to eat my way through the Eternal City, as well as Florence, Bologna, Genoa, Piedmont, and Sardinia. It was heaven. My two Bibles were Victor Hazan's groundbreaking book, Italian Wine, and the blue pocket-size American Express Guide to the Restaurants of Italy. I spent mornings wandering through food markets such as Florence's overflowing Mercato Centrale or Bologna's supernal kitchen specialist Tamburini, feeling vegetables, smelling fruits, eyeing the oils and vinegars, ogling strange creatures from the sea, marveling at unusual cuts of meat and hung game, sniffing wild mushrooms, and savoring salami, cured meat, and cheese. My brother Tom joined me for two of those weeks as Scrabble partner, comrade, and, as importantly, as an extra mouth and stomach. We stayed in cheap pensioni as I had vowed to spend my limited budget not on my pillow, but on my belly. Everywhere I scrutinized menus and analyzed restaurant design. I scribbled in my journal, chronicling and decoding every component that defined the distinctive allure of a trattoria or ristorante. Beyond describing dishes I had loved, the journal entries included notes and sketches for lighting fixtures, menus, architecture, flooring, and seating plans, and, tellingly, notes about how I felt treated wherever I slept or dined. I was developing my vision of my future restaurant by getting to know myself. Never before had I been alone for so long, and the experience was forcing and allowing me to think about and feel what truly mattered to me. In planning this culinary adventure, my father had insisted vehemently that I commit at least as much time to France as to Italy. Before leaving, I hadn't been sure if he was trying to quell my burgeoning passion for Italy, or if, perhaps, his incantations about France were on the mark. In the end, I decided to trust him and assume that he both wanted and knew what was best for me. He had allowed that Italian cooking was brilliant in its simplicity, combining just a few extraordinary ingredients, but he was also orthodox in his insistence that I go to France if I truly wanted to learn technique. He called on a number of his friends from Relais and Chateau and eventually connected me with an acquaintance who owned La Réserve, a hotel and restaurant in the town of Pessac, and the restaurant Du Bern in the center of Bordeaux. Luckily, it was the autumn harvest, the most compelling season to be there, and I could soon see that my father's advice was sage. I was in for a powerful and unforgettable education. Both of the restaurants were closed on Sundays, so on that day I would drive to selected chateau with La Réserve's maître d'hôtel to get a lesson on the great vineyards of Bordeaux. We began at a little-known chateau in Saint-Emilion, moving on to bigger players like Chateau Lascombe in Margaux and Chateau Léoville-Barton in Saint-Julien. My most memorable Sunday excursion was one we took to Chateau Mouton-Rothschild, where we robbed and tasted the first growth from barrels and where I first learned of a new collaboration being formed with Robert Mondavi to be called Opus One. We traveled west to the coastal village of Arcachon, where I learned to slurp down briny blue-fleshed oysters along with dried sausage, brown bread, and butter. Each morning at dawn, I accompanied La Réserve's short, bespectacled head chef, Pierrot, to Bordeaux's food market to learn how he selected all the products for his larder. I visited Chateau Guiraud in Sauternes and went hunting for palom, wild pigeon, and foraging for girolles, chanterelles, and seps, porcini. After my stage ended in November, I took the train up to Paris for the week I had so eagerly anticipated. Audrey was flying to Paris for an 8-day rendezvous with me. As usual, I had turned to my father for his advice on both my culinary and my romantic itinerary. The night before Audrey arrived, anxious, I had eaten myself silly, dining solo on a massive copper pot of cassoulet at La Mazère. I remember sleeping for all of 3 hours that night, both because I was stimulated with excitement and because of the three portions of cassoulet I had consumed. Every time the incredulous waiter had offered more, I would smile and say, "Oui, merci." The cassoulet was expanding in my stomach as I rolled around perspiring in my lumpy bed. After she arrived, Audrey and I continued the Parisian eating affair. We began with foie gras and sauterne in our shabby hotel room, and we dined at the two-star Chez Michel, the one-star Piloufas, the brasserie Vaudeville and Au Pied du Cochon, and the bistros Allard and Benoit. From Paris, we took the overnight Orient Express to Venice, where we feasted on razor clams and sepia at Corte Sconta, and risotto with tiny clams at Osteria da Fiore. Then it was on to refined tasting menus at La Frasca and Castro Caro Terme, not far from Bologna, and at Inoteca Pinciori in Florence. There were also more rustic dinners of finocchiona, which is fennel flex salami, coniglio arrosto, rabbit, bisteca alla fiorentina, and endless portions of fagioli drowned in deep green olive oil and black pepper in the trattorias Acqua al Due, Del Fagioli, and Anita. From there, we motored down to Torgiano in Umbria, and then on to Rome, so that I could introduce and show off Audrey, my ragazza, to my Italian family at La Taverna da Giovanni. Of course, they approved, and they began whispering to me that she should soon become my fidanzata, or fiancé. Audrey flew back to New York, and exhausted, I dragged myself by train back up to Florence for the much-anticipated family celebration of my mother's 50th birthday. My advice on where to shop, eat, and sightsee was in great demand, and it was then that I realized just how much I had learned over the past several months. My time in Italy and France had provided a crucial introduction to the real work of restaurants, and nothing I had seen or learned had dissuaded me from continuing to follow my passion. I liked the kind of people I kept meeting in the business, felt blessed being around so much good food and wine, and was intoxicated with the idea of taking an unexpected career path. In my many solitary moments during those 100 days, I had had ample opportunity to contemplate, feel, and envision the kind of restaurant I now knew I had to open. Back in New York, I was a 27-year-old guy from St. Louis who had worked in the restaurant business for a mere 8 months. I knew just a few people in the industry, and very few people beyond the walls of Pesca knew of me. What I did have was an intense desire, a burning sense of urgency, and, having sold my Checkpoint stock, enough cash to get things going. According to my calculations, I would need somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million to open the kind of restaurant I had been dreaming of. The good news financially was that I was thinking of something rustic, not refined, in an off-Broadway rather than a Hollywood style. I knew I would need to raise some additional money in order to open, but I wouldn't know how much or from whom until I first found the ideal restaurant space. I scoured the city, sometimes with brokers, but more often just hunting on my own for unlisted places, seeking the right place in the right location. I had two non-negotiable needs. I wanted to open in an emerging neighborhood, and I wanted to have the right to assign my lease to someone else if my restaurant should go out of business. Having experienced my father's bankruptcies and knowing something about how many new restaurants went belly up, I was soberly aware that failure was a real possibility. With regard to the first point, I wanted to be in an area that could provide a strong lunch business. I had learned from Pesca that a vibrant lunch service could help a restaurant to meet fixed costs, and furthermore, that the kind of business clientele attracted by lunch could give the place an added identity. I also wanted a neighborhood where a modest rent would allow me to offer excellent value to our guests. Part of the adventure of dining out, for many people, is venturing into new surroundings. A dynamic neighborhood would bestow a freshness that could rub off on the restaurant itself. As for the lease, my dad, now a restaurateur himself, having opened a French bistro Chez Louis in St. Louis, had consistently pointed out that if my restaurant were to fail, the lease itself would be my only tangible asset. To this day, getting an assignable lease is the very first piece of advice I give any new restaurateur. In my search for the ideal spot, I had visited more than 100 prospective restaurant sites in at least 10 distinct downtown neighborhoods. One place that captivated me was just off Union Square, an old, stale-smelling vegetarian restaurant on East 16th Street called Brownies. I had been to Union Square just once or twice since I began living in New York, so I was only vaguely aware of its green market, then a small twice-a-week outdoor gathering of cash-crop farmers and a specialist in heirloom apples. This was the closest thing in New York to the markets I had fallen in love with in Italy and France. Though only 6 blocks from Pesca, Union Square felt half a city away. At night, I knew Union Square as the stomping ground of Andy Warhol, Max's Kansas City, and the underground nightclub. By day, the neighborhood was home to the men's garment industry, and the side streets off Fifth Avenue were clogged with rolling racks of slacks and coats. There was a seedy by day, dangerous by night feel to the area. Where Zeckendorf Towers now stand, there was a faltering S-Klein department store. An equally outdated landmark was May's Department Store on 14th Street. A few doors to the east, Luchow's restaurant was in the twilight of its life. I still wasn't sure the neighborhood's future was promising, but the deteriorating conditions made me believe that it would at least offer an opportunity for an excellent lease. The farmer's market was intriguing, And according to Ellen Giddens, the real estate executive who first urged me to follow my instinct on Union Square, this was precisely where the advertising and publishing industries would soon be relocating to escape the escalating rents in Midtown. I was no expert in New York real estate, but I understood on a gut level that if I handicapped the location correctly and could successfully play a role in transforming the neighborhood, my restaurant, with its long-term lease locked in at a low rent, could offer excellence and value. This combination would attract smart, adventurous, loyal customers, in turn giving other restaurants and businesses the confidence to move into the neighborhood until a critical mass had been reached and the neighborhood itself changed for the better. Moreover, were I to go belly up after a few years in such a neighborhood, I was confident that I could find someone else who would then be eager to pay my below-market rent on the remaining years of my lease. I sensed a lot of upside and felt protected against the downside. I called Eugene